You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, March 16th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Christy Ford Chapin, assistant professor of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, author of Ensuring America's Health, the public creation of the corporate healthcare system. Also on the program today, federal judge blocks Trump's travel ban. And the Trump budget slashes everything but for defense and vouchers for private schools. Meanwhile, the Trump administration ups its use of drone strikes, drops its concern for civilian casualties, and sends another 1,000 soldiers to Syria. Paul Ryan surveys the underside of the Obamacare replace and repeal bus, courtesy of President Trump, and Seb Gorka. Will we have him in country much longer?
I'm due for a promotion due to the latest revelations, in fact.
He may very well have lied, or by omission, in his citizen application.
Well, I've never. I am not a communist.
And Geert Wilders.
Oh, is that a Dutch impression? That's actually not bad.
Just trying to say his name. I don't know.
Geert Wilders.
Geert Wilders. Very bad for Belgium.
Loses in the Dutch election, at least for now. And new unsealed documents show that Monsanto's Roundup may very well be more toxic than we knew before. And they accidentally ghost wrote some research for academics.
That called in to harass us about.
All that and more.
I don't know who the science is on Monsanto.
All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, another just rather dense 24 hours of news, really 16 hours of news that kept me up all night. It's just habit. I feel like there are like 10 business days to a week now. Yes. I went to Hayes's program, and like two stories broke out during the show, during that hour. Like the Muslim ban and then Donald Trump's already attempting to sever himself from Paul Ryan, throwing Ryan under the bus, Ryan throwing his own plan under the bus.
A lot of buses.
There was a lot of buses.
But it's preliminary buses.
Preliminary buses. Let's play that one because that's that. Let's play number six. As you know, the Republican plan to repeal and replace Obamacare is a disaster from a policy standpoint. If you believe the CBO numbers, 24 million people will lose their insurance by 2020. To be fair, if you believe the White House numbers, 26 million will lose their insurance coverage by 2020. And also, to be fair, for 35-year-olds making over $50,000 a year, insurance will go down. For everybody else, the premiums and out-of-pockets will go up. But that's the price for freedom.
It's preliminary price for freedom.
But so here is Tucker Carlson sitting down with Donald Trump after I imagine they exchanged pleasantries about their respective hairs. And Tucker Carlson says, you know, all the reports seem to suggest that this is really bad for the people who voted for you. And here is Donald Trump taking Paul Ryan and throwing him under the bus. Not by name, but I think it's pretty clear.
The bill has as one of its centerpieces a tax cut for investors that would primarily benefit people making over $250,000 a year. Already done pretty well in the past 10 years, as you know.
Yeah.
A Bloomberg analysis showed that counties that voted for you, middle class and working class counties, would do far less well under this bill than the counties that voted for Hillary, the more affluent counties.
I know.
Seems like maybe this isn't consistent with the message of the last election.
No, a lot of things aren't consistent, but these are going to be negotiated.
There you have it. A lot of things are not consistent, and these things are going to be negotiated.
Yeah, a lot of things aren't.
Now, here's the thing that is frustrating me about this, about the entire conversation around here. And that is basically the same thing, one of the same things that have been frustrating me for some time. There's this notion that somehow, you know, Paul Ryan has not stuck up to, you know, has not stood up to Donald Trump and he's going to get his due. This is Paul Ryan's plan. If anything, it is been muted in some respects than Paul Ryan's original plan. The Republicans passed in 2015 in both the House and the Senate a repeal and replace bill. They sent it to President Obama. He, of course, vetoed it. The idea that the establishment media, the Beltway media, that the talking heads on TV, that every single person isn't talking about how craven were and are the Republicans. Rich Lowry wrote a piece that I think actually really, in many respects, is interesting analysis. In other respects, continues to cloud the issue. He writes, the bill has had the worst rollout of any major piece of legislation in memory. The failures, and failure is very much an option. That was actually a title of one of my scripts and a story written about me in the Boston Globe. Put that aside. If the proposal falters, it will be a political debacle that could poison President Trump's relationship with Congress for the duration. Let's hope. This is a product of how the Republican sweep of 2016 was won on separate tracks. Trump tore up many Republican orthodoxies and went out and found a different way to unlock the electoral map. First of all, this notion that Trump tore up many Republican orthodoxies is BS. He de-emphasized that he wouldn't cut entitlements. And then beyond that, that was basically it. The overt racism. Right. That was contrary to Republican orthodoxy, which is really a little bit more subtle racism. Nevertheless, congressional Republicans more or less stuck with the usual script. And of course, he's being very clear not to point out what that is. Kept Trump at arm's length, held their majorities in the House and the Senate. The faction most favorable to Trump, the House Freedom Caucus, is made up of ideological conservatives whose philosophy is at odds with Trump's economic populism, even if they're drawn to his anti-establishmentarianism. Perhaps. There was no off-the-shelf Trump legislation that Congress could begin on immediately. In the campaign, Trump identified a constituency and a message, but the agenda was often symbolic. The natural reflex then was to defer to the Republican leadership in Congress. Trump could have come roaring out of the gate with one of his distinctive proposals, the $1 trillion infrastructure plan, and wooed Democrats to support it and dared Republicans to oppose it. Instead, infrastructure has been put off for a second year, a polite way of saying it may not happen at all. That's true, because Donald Trump obviously didn't even care about that at all.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't. It's preliminary.
The congressional priorities are Obamacare repeal and tax reform, both of which could have easily been the first-year agenda items of the aforementioned hypothetical Presidents Bush, Rubio, or Cruz. They will have to be passed without Democratic votes and through the Senate reconciliation process that circumvents the filibuster. It's true that Trump promised to deliver on both, but neither were part of his core message. The Speaker is pursuing simultaneously with repeal because that's Trump's preference as opposed to just replace. The president's been supportive of Ryan's bill while maintaining his flexibility. Look, the idea that this repeal and replace bill wouldn't have run into the same headwinds or a different one wouldn't have run into the same headwinds with a President Bush or Rubio is ridiculous. There is no way for the Republicans to deal with this question unless they are honest about it, which is, we don't want to cover anybody. We just want a tax cut. I guess theoretically, they could have replaced, just repealed, left nothing, and let the whole thing go into a complete chaos situation. But you would have still seen the same numbers. You would have seen the CBO come out and score what happens when you repeal this. And that is an $800 billion tax cut for that same group of people making over $200,000 as individuals, $250,000 as a couple. And you would have seen the same numbers of uninsured. So this whole notion that somehow this is just a function of Trump. Trump is making it harder for the Republicans in Congress, no doubt. But the fundamental problem the Republicans have is they're selling basically rotted fruit. And it's in cellophane packaging, and we can see it.
Maybe they want to eat rotted fruit. Maybe that's freedom.
That's freedom. They get the freedom to have the...
Actually, in fact, when we look at the... We don't even have time to get to the USDA agenda, but yeah.
But the problem that we have in our politics is that Rich Lowry can write this, and there's no Democrats out there who are leading the charge against this.
That's not true.
I mean, that's the problem. Is there's
fake
no
news.
There's you know the resistance, and this was there's a certain inevitability about this, is anti-Trump.
And breaking news.
And it is not anti-Republican policies.
As we predicted and said a gazillion times.
And so even so everybody, and I mean everybody, is on board the Protect Obamacare train.
Yes. From the Communist Party USA to Jonathan Chait to, in practicality, Susan Collins.
A whole array of people. Instead of how can we take the next step with the Affordable Care Act. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to figure out how we got to this situation where we have such an effed up healthcare system in this country. And, well, it turns out it was the doctors.
Son of a bitches.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Christy Ford Chapin on ensuring America's health, the public creation of the corporate healthcare system. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Welcome to the program. Christy Ford Chapin. She is an assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of Ensuring America's Health, the Public Creation of the Corporate Healthcare System. Welcome to the program, Christy.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
So we have such a bizarre system relative to just about everywhere else in the world, it seems like. And you basically tell the history of how we got here, and it involves three major, I guess, forces that influenced the cart before the horse system that we have, it feels like, in terms of providing healthcare service. Walk us through, first tell us who those three major players were, and then walk us through this history.
Okay, sure. The three major players that I look at in my book are the American Medical Association, also known as Organized Physicians, the Health Insurance Association of America, which people probably know today as AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. That's a trade association that represents commercial or for-profit insurance companies. And also Blue Cross Blue Shield, they are also insurance companies. A lot of them today are for-profit, but at a lot of the history I look at, most of those plans were nonprofit until the 1980s and later.
So let me just ask you about the Blue Cross Blue Shield, and then we'll go into we'll start on sort of tracking this history. But so who started Blue Cross Blue Shield? I mean, it was a nonprofit, so was it mostly charities or what? How did Blue Cross Blue Shield come about as a nonprofit?
It actually came about on two different tracks. It was hospital systems that launched Blue Cross, and the plans were actually separate from Blue Shield, which were launched out of AMA medical societies. So it was very interesting because the hospitals were very supportive of the nonprofit mission of Blue Cross for it to be an insurance, but not an insurance company, an insurance plan. They didn't like to call, for example, their customers subscribers. They were members. The organization very much had a culture of nonprofit outlook, trying to provide the most generous policies possible and sign as many people up as possible. Blue Shield was also a nonprofit launched out of AMA medical societies. Their character tended to be different because doctors were more hostile towards them. Plus, Blue Cross was coming out of hospitals which were much more accustomed to charity, getting, you know, funding from local governments, local charity campaigns. So it was just a different outlook. So the physicians launched Blue Shield. They also had nonprofit status. But as they developed, they in areas across the country, Blue Cross and Blue Shield often merged
and
to become, yeah.
When did those launch, like timing-wise?
So the first Blue Cross plan launched in 1929, and so Blue Cross really spread during the 1930s. The AMA was initially very hostile towards them, but once the AMA finally accepted and approved insurance, which wasn't until the end of the 1930s, they went ahead and approved Blue Cross They also approved the ability for their own constituent societies to launch these plans. But within the AMA, it was always some people were very much for them, some people opposed, didn't like the idea of the medical societies being involved in it. So the way those Blue Shield plans develop really depends on what state or what area you're talking about or looking at.
Okay, so you write, and this is this is a rather strange experience for me, but to find myself, sort of in somewhat of agreement with Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity has, for whatever reason, and occasionally I listen, been touting some guy in some doctor, I don't know where it was, maybe in Kansas or something, he's just found out about, that has a prepaid physician group. And apparently this model existed in the 1900s through the 1940s. Tell us what that was and how that got edged out and what the merits were of that system.
Yes. If you go back and look pre-1940s, pre-1950s, the surprising thing about the healthcare market, well, first of all, it didn't look anything like it does today. There were all these different models of financing and providing healthcare. Some were run by unions, some by farmers associations, some by African American fraternal orders. You know, there was just a myriad of different ways that people were organizing healthcare. Now, one of the most popular models, and certainly the most elegant when you're looking at provision of care, quality of care, and most important for today's discussion is keeping healthcare costs down, were these prepaid physician groups. Prepaid physician groups. So first of all, you have the physician group. A lot of people probably thinking, oh, well, we have physician groups today. But if you think about it, our physician groups today are single specialty. So you will only find an orthopedic group only has orthopedists or only general practitioners, the pediatricians, or whatever the specialty might be. But these early prepaid physician groups were multi-specialty. So you would have all the different specialties operating out of one plan. That way the consumer, the patient, is just going to one spot in order to get all the different healthcare services that they need.
So you go to one office building and there's a general practitioner and then there's an orthopedic and there's a dermatologist and whatnot, that type of thing.
Exactly. And what I found in my research, too, is that it was just a great model because they really, the different specialties learned from one another. At the end of the day, it was customary for the doctors to meet together and discuss the difficult cases, you know, the routine cases they didn't need to talk about. But, you know, maybe the elderly lady with a lot of different conditions or somebody who they can't figure out what's wrong with them, they would get, you know, physicians from across specialties meeting to discuss how to treat that patient, care for them, or figure out their diagnosis. So that was great even from the learning perspective of physicians and, of course, the quality of care that of patients received.
So the way it would work would be I would pay whatever it is, $10 a person in my family each month, whether I need health care or not, essentially.
Exactly. But the big difference being that you're paying it directly to a physician instead of an insurance company. So that made a huge difference as far as keeping costs down, because first of all, you're cutting out an entire layer of administration, administrators, supervisors, and corporate, you know, rules and procedures. But the most important point about that is you're incentivizing the physician exactly as you should. You've probably heard, you know, in healthcare debates, some people criticizing some systems, like our system, the insurance company model we have. Because of the way physicians are paid, they're incentivized to provide too much care to people with insurance. It's just the way they're incentivized. They behave rationally. All of us would do it. But on the other hand, I'm sure you've heard people criticize other systems. For example, I'll use England as an example, where not enough services are provided. Care is rationed. It's long waits to get surgeries that don't take a lot of time to get here, or cancer treatments. The great thing about the prepaid physician group is the physician had no incentive to either oversupply or undersupply care. Because if they were stingy about providing services or procedures, then word gets around, they lose patients, they lose profit. But if, they're just for no reason trying to run up a bill that doesn't make any sense either, because they're just taking money out of their own back pocket.
So let me ask you about both those ends of it, okay? Because my understanding, in terms of providing too much care, one example of that was borne out in that sort of famous piece that Atul Gawande wrote maybe a decade ago, mm-hmm. about two different towns in Texas, mm-hmm. which theoretically should have the same health outcome, or did have the same health outcomes, more or less, but had more or less the same inputs in terms of demographics and whatnot, except for Medicare costs were about 20 to 30% higher in one town versus the other. And according to his piece, it was because the doctors in that town tended to own their own medical equipment. So when they're over-providing care, it's like, hop into the MRI, you know, for whatever ails you, because I got one. And why not use it? And the only reason why not use it is that it's not necessarily called for, and it costs more money, and it's just as effective to do something else, or maybe more effective. I mean, is that how we can understand providing too much care in that instance? And B, how does the advent of these advanced medical devices implicate that program today? Because if that's what we talk about when we talk about providing too much care, it seems to me, you know, in your group, everybody could have their, you know, their medical device that, well, let's all just agree that we're going to use these.
That's a great question. And I really like that piece that you're referring to. Prepaid doctor groups actually completely mitigate this problem. In fact, a lot of states have state laws preventing physicians from owning their own equipment for this very reason, from owning their own labs, MRIs, all types of equipment. But if you look back to the history, you see a lot of these prepaid physician groups had their own equipment. They had their own ambulatory surgery facilities and labs and such. And again, this was absolutely fine because there was no concern about them trying to just run up a bill that they're then just shipping off to a third party. The problem with the system we have today, the insurance company model, what I call the insurance company model, is that physicians, they want to oversupply care because if they run up a bill, of course, you know, telling themselves they're just providing gold standard care, but if they run off a bill, what do they care? They're not socking the poor patient with it. You know, that would also prevent them if it's a patient who, you know, they have a relationship with. But instead, they're just sending it to a corporation, right? A cold, bureaucratic corporation somewhere far away. So you can see how that's incentivizing people differently. If physicians own their own groups, their own prepaid groups, they don't have incentive to use the MRI machine if there's no need to. In fact, it just makes good sense in a lot of cases that some of them would own some of their own equipment, because it would be easier for the patient to get this stuff done in the same place instead of going all over town to get the labs and the different things. But they wouldn't have any incentive to do it unless it was necessary.
But is it the cost of operating an MRI that is what incentivizes you, or is it that I've outlaid whatever hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay for it, and I gotta meet my monthly, you know, I don't know, how do you get mortgage or whatever it is on the MRI?
Right. So physicians would only be incentivized to even purchase that MRI machine if they had a practice where they knew they would use it enough to make for it to make sense. Otherwise, they might say, you know, I'm in an area where we already have enough saturation of these machines. I wouldn't get enough use out of it. It makes no sense for my practice to invest in this. But perhaps you're a physician practice where, I don't know, maybe you're orthopedist or you do something neurologically or something where it makes sense, then you would. But you see, a lot of these laws have kind of built up, and a lot of these problems have built up around this really strange insurance company model we have that the AMA created back in the 1930s that puts the insurance companies kind of in this cat and mouse game with physicians. You know, physicians don't have the correct incentives. They're being increasingly supervised and regulated by insurance companies, which nobody wants. But the insurance companies are doing this, keep putting more rules, and states keep putting more regulations to try desperately, and they keep failing to contain costs.
Right. All right. Well, let's move to and I just, I guess the other angle I wanted to touch on was in terms of rationing, and to the extent that we have that in this country, it is broadly speaking, you know, these the notions of how insurance companies want to make sure that they still have a margin. And mm-hmm. they don't want to pay for certain things, or they slow walk certain things, or they, at least prior to the ACA and maybe perhaps in the near future, would have things like rescission or lifetime caps or annual caps or jacked up premiums for people who are more likely to use health insurance, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. all a form of rationing. So mm-hmm. let's take us back to how this developed. So we had these prepaid doctor groups, and I would also just, I think it's probably necessary to have the caveat that in certain geographic areas, it may not be as viable, right? Because you don't necessarily have the same, it may not be profitable enough for people to be able to do something like this. Is that the case or no?
I don't know. I mean, I guess you could say maybe in rural areas,
right.
the practices would be smaller and you wouldn't have as many specialists. You know, perhaps it would be a pediatrician, a general practitioner if you were really out somewhere. But I don't see why it wouldn't be viable, particularly because basically what would end up happening is people would buy into their local plan, and then the local plans would set up some kind of credit system amongst themselves so that patients could access care wherever they were, because, you know, people travel, people move.
Right.
But I think it's viable, particularly if physicians want to kind of get back, if we want the patient and the physicians back in the driver's seat of medical care, because right now we're caught in a system where the insurance companies are actually shaping the way medicine is practiced, because the way physicians and hospitals are reimbursed is very much according to a standardized treatment blueprint. And so the insurance companies are very much straitjacketing physicians and what they can do. A lot of the creativity is gone. A lot of the, hey, I understand that this patient needs something differently than this patient because of age or gender. I just know their background. They don't have that creativity that they used to do, because if they don't follow the steps exactly as the insurance company says, they're not going to get their reimbursement.
All right, so let's go back. So we had in the 1900s, early 1900s through the 30s and in the 40s, these prepaid doctor groups as one sort of, I guess, primary mechanism in which people would be able to access healthcare. And the AMA was worried about these things. Why?
Yeah, it's kind of an anxiety that's very hard for us to understand today. And that's because turn of the 20th century, first few decades of the 20th century, people were very freaked out, I suppose I should say, about corporations and corporate power. Today we're kind of used to Walmarts and McDonald's and massive corporations.
I'm a little freaked out by it. Okay.
But I think we almost cannot understand the level of anxiety because, you know, humankind having existed for so many thousands of years, and all of a sudden you have these massive bureaucratic hierarchies that were very powerful, and especially in the United States, more powerful than the government often, unlike Europe.
And I think, too, we had a politics at that time that was pointedly antitrust, right? I mean, you had Teddy Roosevelt specifically, you know, within decades of this era, specifically going after these large, trusts, essentially.
Right. You had a lot of people, you know, one faction within the progressives saying, is this really how we should even allow the economy to be organized? Should we force everything to stay much smaller? So those were debates that were going on. Now, within professions, you're looking at lawyers, engineers, doctors. They're also worried about, you know, what is their place going to be in this corporate society? How are they going to keep their professional position if you have these gigantic, powerful, massive, you know, bureaucracy running things? So quite rationally, physicians were scared of the corporation. They didn't want to become like the engineers sucked into it and have to become part of it. So, you know, with imagine managers who were not even physicians managing them. So the reason they so fiercely oppose these prepaid doctor groups, and it's such a shame they did, is because they were afraid they were going to turn into medical corporations. You know, just that they were nascent medical corporations. You had capital pooling, you know, you had multi-specialty that showed, you know, the different, you know, departments, so to speak. So the AMA really did quite a great job of shutting them down, certainly preventing their growth. In some cases, they did get them shut down because the AMA members, by and large, controlled state licensing boards. So physicians who crossed their will on any piece of policy stood to have their license pulled. And the AMA was very open about this. They talked about it in the Journal of the American Medical Association. They released warnings saying, we will come after you and have your license pulled. Also, the other thing they would do, because they had so much influence over hospitals, is have their hospital admitting privileges revoked as well.
So how much involvement at this point? So the AMA was big enough to be able to sort of control a lot of these state regulatory bodies. How much involvement did the feds have at that time?
Are you talking 1930s, for example? Well, I would say 1930s is when you're starting to have healthcare reformers who had previously looked at having some kind of government provision of healthcare pass through the states at the state level. And in the 1930s is the first time they're actually starting to look at the federal government to provide healthcare. And that's, of course, because we're in the Great Depression, the crisis, the economic crisis. Is seen as an opportunity for a lot of reformers. And of course, the healthcare sector looks like it's prime for reform, especially since the AMA has gone through the sector shutting down a lot of the great financing and delivery experiments that were going on. It made sense that the government officials would look at this sector as a place to intervene. The 1935 Social Security Bill, which provides really the foundation of the modern welfare state. It looked like for a time there was going to be a healthcare provision in it, but in the end, President Roosevelt asked the Social Security Committee to strip it out because he did not want to have to go up against the AMA. The AMA is organized as a national body. It also has all its state constituent bodies and then county or city medical society. So you see, has a lot of political power to lobby, you know, congressmen and senators and governors and state houses and the federal government as well. So that's when really the 1930s is when the push begins. So, you know, Roosevelt does create a working group to look at this. There's a national healthcare conference. For the first time at the end of the 1930s, you have Senator Wagner offering legislation for federal funding of healthcare. So that's really where you see the push beginning to reform healthcare. And of course, most famously, the following decade with Harry Truman in the latter half of the 1940s, proposing national health care, health insurance, which then is defeated by organized physicians and insurance companies and business groups.
Now, so was it for health insurance, or wasn't there at one point also a push to federally fund these doctors groups, or did that come later?
So that's the great thing that, well, would have been the great thing if the Truman Plan had passed, is the people in the Truman administration who were specialists in healthcare and looking at putting this bill together, I found in my research it was quite clear that they were hoping with the bill not just to create universal healthcare, but to kind of destroy the insurance company model that the AMA had created, because everybody, I mean, even the insurance companies and Republicans, Democrats, everybody realized this insurance company model was kind of a disaster and was going to cause costs to rise very rapidly and make it difficult to cover people. So the Truman Bill was an attempt to provide insurance. A lot of times they would use the saying prepaid health care. That's the same. It's a synonym for insurance. But they were hoping to do a lot of this funding through prepaid physician groups. But as you know, as I mentioned, that plan was defeated. But
well,
if they had passed
what were the forces? Was it the AMA that defeated it because they were afraid of the corporation? Was it the insurance industry that defeated it at that point? I mean, what was the incentive for the insurance company to get involved? I mean, how did people step up to the, because at that point, right, they were doing stuff like life insurance or property insurance. Mm-hmm. What made them step into that business?
Well, that's a really good question, because in the 1930s, it's around 1938 that AMA finally, because they're starting to come under so much federal pressure, you know, they've been stamping out the prepaid physician groups. They've been stamping out, you know, the union-run health care plans, the fraternal orders. They've been beating back the market in every way they can. And they because of the federal pressure, they realized, look, we can't just keep beating down the market for health care, or we're never going to be able to fight the government reform. So they continue to oppose physician groups. They don't want any, you know, multi-specialty groups, but they finally accept insurance. But it can't be just any kind of insurance. It has to be this very specific model, this insurance company model, where insurance would be run through insurance companies that were previously either property and casualty or life insurance companies. And they think that by doing this, you know, they can stay in the driver's seat, that they will make the rule is that insurance companies aren't allowed to supervise them at all, and they have to pay them what is called fee-for-service payments, which means they're paid for each and every service or procedure they offer to a patient. Even in one office visits, you know, visit, they're trying to offer different services and procedures to run up the bill. And so the AMA leaders think this is the best way. They'll accept insurance, but it's going to be this very, very specific type of insurance. And, you know, quite rationally, insurers look at this and think, no way. You know, there's no way. Why would we want to get involved with basically you guys tell us how much we should pay? You know, that's a suicide mission. How are we ever going to turn a profit on that? So the insurance companies do get dragged in during the 1930s, kind of kicking and screaming about it. But they have corporate clients who they're already providing pension products and life insurance to. The corporate clients keep asking for health care benefits because, you know, they're trying to prevent union organizing. They also like these benefits to keep labor turnover rates down. So there's a lot of pressure on insurance companies to join with the AMA in this. It's an economic project in that, you know, the AMA kind of whole cloth out of nowhere invents this healthcare model, but it's also very much, and they say this over and over again, it's explicitly a political project, and that they feel like they need something, and this is the model, the insurance company model, in order to keep back any kind of government reform. Something they can hold up and say, we don't need government reform. We've got this great model here.
Every chapter of this story seems to be a political response to stem the tide of what would be effective, most cost-effective, like a policy implementation, right? I mean, it's whether to prevent, unions from empowering themselves, or to prevent just average citizens from empowering. I mean, it seems like at every stance, even the fear of corporations ends up driving the growth of other corporations and the power of other corporations to intervene in this dynamic.
Oh, absolutely. And in such an ironic story, too, because here's the AMA doing everything they can to prevent corporate power, and you know, of course, it would take many, many decades for this to develop. But now physicians are in a position where they're no longer calling the shots, and they've built this model that's empowered the insurance companies over time.
And so, okay, so that's we've been focusing on the AMA. What did the Health Insurance Association of America and Blue Cross Blue Shield? I mean, they must have at different points basically intervened to, again, corral expansive public policy, right? I mean, the next stop would probably be Medicare, where they said, okay, we're perfectly willing to have you take the presumably most expensive part of our risk pool and subsidize that and take care of it yourself as long as we get a little piece in terms of administration. Speaking of Medicare and Medicaid, but we still want where all the money is.
Right. Actually, Medicare is an interesting story because it did divide the industry. You still had a good portion of the for-profit industry trying to keep its alliance with organized physicians, because the AMA made the political, you know, made the decision for political strategy, and I think a lot of them regretted it later because they lost so much standing and political standing after they lost the Medicare battle. But a lot of insurance companies made the decision to stand with the AMA to oppose Medicare on, you know, the basic idea that they didn't want the government involved in medicine. But even the insurance companies standing still with AMA didn't really want to do much about it. Like you said, it was a great deal for them, push off the sickest and costliest subscribers they have. In fact, in order to please doctors or and for some of them to follow a more conservative ideology that wanted to keep the government out, insurance companies actually went to incredible lengths to in an attempt to cover those over age 65. They got state enabling legislation that allowed them to get around antitrust laws to pool so that a lot of different companies could pool their resources and administrative capacity to offer really kind of bare bones policies to the elderly, which they lost money on anyway. So, of course, by the time, you know, the Medicare debates are really picking up, you know, late 50s, early 1960s with the passage in 65, yeah, a lot of insurance companies, Blue Cross comes out in favor of Medicare.
And I think, I mean, and you probably have a better sense than I would about this, but my sense is that the reason why insurance companies ultimately supported the Affordable Care Act was because they were in the same way that they knew that they could not cover the elderly, no matter what, that the business model simply did not work for the people who needed it the most. They were coming with an aging population in this country to realize that their current business model was also unsustainable. And it seems to me there was a time where the insurance companies were like, we're okay with a 55 and over Medicare buy-in because, again, we want to shrink our risk pool to people who are a lot less costly. But when the Affordable Care Act showed up, and it was around since, I guess, the early 90s, in some form or another, the idea of a mandate, oh, okay, well, our model will work if we can force everybody to buy insurance. That might work out for us in the individual market. Is that basically how it went down?
Well, I would say there were three reasons. First, the very point that you're making, a program that would force young people to purchase insurance looked really good to them because, you know, they can't get people off their rolls until they're 65. To be able to get more young people into the system through the individual market, that was good for them. The second reason is just that, you know, they realized that with the election of President Obama and the Congress being held by Democrats, that this was going to happen. And the most politically astute thing to do in such a case is to get in and to negotiate so that you can help write the provisions that'll benefit you. If the writing is on the wall and there's a 90% chance something's going to pass, you have a lot more to lose by opposing it. And then the third reason I would point to that for both the AMA and insurance companies supporting the ACA is it was kind of like a labor negotiation between the two. You'll notice if you go back and look at AMA and insurance company support for the ACA, it was often attached to certain stipulations. For the insurance companies, it was the mandate that young, healthy people buy insurance, but it was also that they were asking for more control over providers, more control over how doctors and hospitals operate. On the other end, you saw the AMA saying, yes, we support the AMA, the ACA. We just want, you know, our Medicare payments to stay a certain way, and we want more freedom and more autonomy in the way we practice. We want more protection from insurance companies. So it's kind of this proxy labor negotiation between, you know, the corporate, you know, powers on one side, the insurance companies, and the physician, you know, workers on the other side.
So does there need to be any, I mean, does there need to be statutory authority to start these doctor groups again, or I mean, could this just happen?
Well, you know, it could happen if the Republicans would look at the ACA and really, you know, think about this. This is a moment where they could, you know, fix things and help things and keep, you know, what's in place, and then do a few things in order to allow these prepaid physician groups to come back. And really, I think one of the main things would be having to write legislation that would release these prepaid doctor groups from a lot of state laws, because a lot of these state laws passed, you know, with the best of intentions, in a desperate attempt to keep costs down, would make it almost impossible to start them. So, for example, if these physician groups did, it would make a lot of sense for them to own their own equipment, but there'd be state laws against it. Or there might be state laws against them deciding how to divide up their labor within the group. That's another great thing about these prepaid physician groups. You probably know there's been a lot of push, for example, to let nurses and nurse practitioners do more. But state law, and it varies in all 50 states, what a nurse can and can't do, what a physician can do. They just need a lot more freedom to operate. And there are just so many regulations that's what the Republican Congress could actually do to help. And then they could actually hold this up before their voters and say, look, we are actually returning conditions to market, more like a market. This is the system we have here. This is not some competitive market system. That's a myth. It's just simply not the case that this is something that we need to uphold and protect. But we can do this and then keep the ACA framework, give subsidies to people to be able to buy into these things, and then get their savings by bending the cost curve down and keep things generous. Make it so that, you know, people are able to go out there and buy good health insurance but save money by bringing the cost of healthcare down.
So the irony is, though, is that the Republicans would have to sort of concede the point that, in fact, it's not federal intervention that is stymieing these things. There's no federal law that says you can't, insurance companies, for instance, can't compete state to state. These are all state, the states are actually too autonomous in many respects in this realm. And I guess it would be nice if Republicans in Congress could bring themselves to be aware of that. But I suspect that is an ideological choice that won't happen. Although that's what I find so interesting about, Sean Hannity touting these things. I don't think he fully understands maybe that it's really the states that are preventing the growth of these things as opposed to anything else.
Yes.
And the lack of federal intervention in curbing state autonomy that is a hindrance here. And like you say, the role for the federal government, I mean, how would that implicate, let's say, Medicaid or Medicare?
Well, I think if there was a way that we could start getting these, I think these things would take off because it offers so much for patients, for physicians, and that would start bending the cost curve down. Just Medicare has had programs where they allow people to opt out and go into managed care. Medicaid is the same way. Of course, it operates differently in each state. But once, you know, people stand back and start letting people organize these things and figure them out, I don't think it would take much, and it'd be very easy for state Medicaid programs to start migrating patients over. And the great thing is we're not talking about something that saves costs by offering inferior care or rationing care. We're talking about something that unleashes the creativity of physicians, allows them to do things, you know, we can only begin to imagine, while incentivizing them to keep costs down. So I think that would happen quite naturally with both the Medicare and Medicaid programs.
It's fascinating stuff, and it is interesting to note that it's almost as if the debate is on like an entirely wrong playing field at this point, as opposed to the outcome is almost preordained because we're playing soccer on a baseball field.
No, that's such a good point. I mean, that's what's been so frustrating about watching these debates. You know, even the discussion of the ACA, the costs. Yes, the costs are going up. They're scheduled to go up another 20% this year, but kind of the losing focus of the point that the ACA was built on something that was already faulty. You know, the Democrats did try to change that, I'm sure you remember, with the public option.
Yes.
They did want to kind of get in there and loosen and weaken the insurance company model.
Right. The public option was essentially attempting to be sort of the, I don't know, I guess a seed of poison in the system, or maybe a seed of a cure to the system in a way.
Right. Exactly. Right.
Well, thank you, Joe Lieberman, and I guess Kent Conrad. And thank you, Christy Ford Chapin. The book is Insuring America's Health, the Public Creation of the Corporate Healthcare System. We will link to it at majority.fm. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Sam. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Fascinating. I mean, I literally heard Sean Hannity touting this thing on Monday. I was listening to him, I think it was. God help me.
Sean is not the brightest.
It's true. It's true.
I mean, if you're looking for bright, Sean is not the one.
I mean, the thing is that it does sound like a really good idea. If you had federal subsidies for these things too, people would have the ability to pay for them. I don't know how much it would cost a month, but I imagine it would certainly be less than insurance companies, which are taking 20% off the top minimum.
Yep.
And then all the administrative costs that are involved with the doctor's office having to file the insurance, and then all the time you have to spend filing your insurance, there would be huge savings, it seems to me. And in the context of a Medicare, you've already got very small administrative costs. You would get rid of things like the overbilling to Medicaid, the people setting up a P.O. box and selling certain devices, maybe. I mean, maybe some of that would continue based upon what some of the things that Medicaid covers. But, I mean, it seems like a very good solution. And despite the fact that Sean Hannity was touting it, it would be fun to watch him just totally reverse himself when he sees that it actually is.
One time O'Reilly was fucking drunk, which is all the time. And he chose this one time that he was blitzed to convince Hannity to support universal health care because Reagan supported it. And then when Hannity succumbed, O'Reilly goes, "You faggot." It was great.
Well, we should... I'd love to hear more about that time that right-wing Mandela spent hanging out with
fucking
O'Reilly.
Body. But then Al's became too much. Yeah, disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah, when right-wing Mandela tells you you've got a problem harassing women, you know you've got a problem. All right.
True story.
We're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein there will be a significant amount of Gorka impressions today.
Ooh.
In fact, I think I'm probably going to read this entire piece from the foreword in the voice of Gorka, even though it's only about Gorka and it's not actually quoting Gorka.
May have lied on immigration forms.
Exclusive. Nazi allied group claims top Trump aide Sebastian Gorka as a sworn member.
They pricked my thumb in blood.
First of all, this piece of journalism, if that's what you want to call it, is garbage. It never refers to me as doctor. You can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, what we do is we give you extra programming every day, virtually every non-snow day. We give you extra programming, and you keep this program chugging along and hopefully growing. And we have some plans, but you know, best laid plans. And also, you can support this program by if you purchase stuff from Amazon or Jet.com. You can do so through our link. You will notice no difference in your purchase experience, but we will get a kickback. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on either the Amazon or the jet.com links, and always purchase your Jet or Amazon stuff through those links. We get a kickback. Thus, we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. It always helps. And, I don't know, subscribe to our YouTube page and see you in the fun half, 646-257-3920.